Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Alan, how are we doing today?
We're very froggy, but don't worry. This is my 37th Ludens that I've eaten today. So at any moment, the candy masquerading as a cough drop will come save me.
Again, well, we can save all this audio for our Rational Security mukbang that we've been talking about since season one of the show. Your voice, you have a deep voice generally, I think. And when you get gravelly, I can feel it in my molars. I think maybe it's the headphones I'm wearing, but the bass is just echoing through my head in a way that's not unpleasing.
You have an ASMR. I was going to say, is this, yeah. I feel like this is working for you, Scott.
I know. You have an ASMR future, perhaps. I think cold and flu Alan ASMR channel might be some people's exact ticket. Who knows?
I don't know if cough drops are the best candidate for a mukbang episode. I would probably choose different food.
Challenge accepted.
Yeah, we'll see about that.
It's like when people see how many hot dogs they can eat, just see how quickly you can go through a bag of cough drops.
Do you think when they had, you may be, Quinta and Tyler, you may be too young for this. Alan, I think you'll remember this. Do you remember the old Tootsie Pop commercials where the owl would say one,
I love the owl,
two, and then three licks, and then crunch? Do you think that somebody heard that and they're like, oh, I'm into this, and that's what started the trend? That's the first really on-audio chewing thing I can think of.
Someone needs to start an OnlyFans for that owl and just post those clips.
This has gotten weird fast. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Rational Security. My name is Scott R. Anderson. I am thrilled to be back here in the virtual studio with my two other regular co-hosts, Quinta Jurassic.
Hello.
And Alan Rosenstein, recently released from the contagious diseases ward of his local hospital.
Yeah, but back in the contagious diseases ward of having two small children.
That is the contagious disease ward of your house.
I just want to say they are blessings. Children are blessings and also bioweapons.
Nothing is more persuasive than somebody says something is a blessing when it sounds like they've smoked four packs of cigarettes this day. It has a certain gravitas that evokes my grandparents that I'm like, I've heard this before. It's echoing something for me. Boy. Well, we are thrilled to be joined by none other than Lawfare Managing Editor Tyler McBrien. Tyler, thank you for coming on the podcast today.
Thank you for having me.
Hopefully you are not being affected by any contagious diseases. We've kept you and all the rest of our little staff safely quarantined from Allen, far away from Minnesota. But we are excited to have you here because we have a lot of big national security news to talk through in this week's episode. And we are calling the Allen and the Owl edition in honor of their shared vocal talents. For our first topic this week, topic one, Operation Humble Drop. After months of unsuccessfully pushing the Israeli government to allow more aid into besieged Gaza, the Biden administration has taken matters into its own hands and begun airlifting it in itself. But are its efforts just for show or a sign that it is abandoning its bear hug approach to Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu? And what will it mean for the flow of U.S. assistance to Israel, especially given legal restrictions Israel's actions arguably violate? Topic two, sound legal reasoning and furious agreement. This week, the Supreme Court surprised no one by unanimously reversing the Colorado Supreme Court and holding that former President Trump cannot be kept off the 2024 ballot for having committed insurrection through his involvement in January 6 under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, a move the justices had strongly telegraphed in oral arguments in February. But for a unanimous outcome, the matter did prove surprisingly divisive, with the liberal minority accusing the conservative majority of overreaching to save Trump from possible future disqualification through other avenues. What should we make of the divided opinions in this case, and where does it leave Trump? And topic three, the smog of war. Even as the New York Times finds itself in the midst of an internal and external controversy around its coverage of Hamas's alleged use of sexual assault during the October 7th massacre, the United Nations has released a report lending credibility to the conclusion that sexual assault occurred, if perhaps not in the way that has been reported. How should we parse the competing accounts around this heated and incredibly difficult topic? For our first topic, Quinta, let me hand it over to you to get us started.
So as of the time of recording, the U.S. has now made two rounds of airdrops of humanitarian aid into Gaza, at least some of them with cooperating along with the Jordanian Air Force. This follows a really disturbing incident in Gaza where a number of Palestinians, I think over 100, were killed in a stampede. And after Israeli forces opened fire on them, after a convoy of aid trucks arrived in Gaza, which is a reflection of just how dire the situation is within the Strip and just how hungry people are. So on the one hand, the Biden administration is framing this as, you know, an important step for the United States. It's also gotten a lot of criticism on the grounds that airdropping aid is not actually a particularly effective or cost-efficient way of delivering aid, and also that the decision to take this step may actually indicate that Israel is in violation of some important laws and policies that would potentially prohibit the United States from passing along future military aid. So, Tyler, I know you've been following pretty closely what is going on here in terms of the various policies and legal authorities. Can you talk a little bit about what this says about whether or not ongoing U.S. military aid is potentially in tension with these aid drops?
Yeah. I think there are a couple provisions that people have rightfully raised here. And I will caveat this by saying I think there are other credible reasons to believe that the provision of military aid to Israel violates other laws because of conduct in the war, perhaps allegations of human rights abuses. But this one that I'm about to speak of is specific to foreign aid, to humanitarian aid. So I think when this happened, I and a few other people first thought of the most recent Biden policy, which came on February 8th, which said many things, but the important parts here that from the time of the policy, countries engaged in armed conflict who are receiving U.S. weapons had 45 days to issue written assurances to the Secretary of State on two grounds. First, that the weapons wouldn't be used to commit human rights abuses in violation of international law. And the second, that the recipient country would not block U.S. humanitarian aid in any way. I think there was a recency bias here. I thought of it as well, but I think as many people have pointed out, the 45 days would not end until mid to late March. But others have raised that the blocking of aid already violates a law in the book, a provision of the Foreign Assistance Act of 1961. This provision is called 620I. And one thing that's concerning is that it seems that Biden himself and more explicitly State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller are admitting almost explicitly that the Israeli government is blocking U.S. humanitarian aid. So it seems like a direct violation. Yesterday, in a press conference, Matthew Miller, I'm just going to quote him here because it is pretty explicit, the admission. He said, "I will say some of the obstacles that we have seen from the Israeli political establishment. You have seen ministers in the Israeli government block the release of flour from the port of Ashdod. You have seen ministers of the Israeli government supporting protests that blocked aid from going into Kerem Shalom." So on its face, it's hard to see this as anything other than an admission, I think, that the Israeli government is blocking aid and thus is in violation of 620I and should not receive further weapons. But the Biden administration has not, you know, voiced any sort of desire to stop sending weapons.
And I'm assuming there's no mechanism for forcing the Biden administration to suspend aid.
None that I've seen. I think that's why you've seen some Democratic lawmakers, including Senator Van Hollen, Senator Sanders, essentially just issuing statements urging the Biden administration to enforce it themselves.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's worth thinking a little bit about what the 620I restriction says and how it's implemented. So 620I is a section of the Foreign Assistance Act that pretty categorically says to the I'm paraphrasing, I'm not quoting here, but something to the effect of, look, anybody who blocks U.S. humanitarian assistance can't receive U.S. foreign assistance of various stripes. Now, it's worth noting there are a variety under the Foreign Assistance Act, I should say, which incorporates a lot of security assistance, but not all. So other security assistance authorities that might not be covered by this bar. There are also, you know, notwithstanding authorities that can be used, notwithstanding other restrictions and laws, things like this. And exactly which bucket is used for which type of security assistance being provided to Israel, I don't know off the top of my head. I'm confident it is a diverse potpourri of legal authorities that get invoked, or at least could be invoked, for different types of aid going to Israel. So I don't think we should pretend that even if you were to apply this provision, it would actually cut off 100% of assistance. But I have no doubt it would be a substantial barrier. The thing about wording like this is that it's tricky, and the way it gets played out between the political branches. Because on its face, you couldn't apply the terms of this law facially. Because states, foreign states, inevitably prevent the transfer of goods across their borders. You know, would you interpret this to say a country could not require that U.S. humanitarian assistance go through its customs and its agricultural safety and public health safety screening procedures before it's distributed, if it's food or agricultural products? I think that would be a really problematic way to interpret this law for recipient countries, because recipient countries would say, yes, maybe we're developing, maybe we're in a conflict, maybe we need U.S. foreign assistance, but we still need to be able to exercise the incidence of sovereignty and do things like preserve the public health and of our population, the health of our agricultural sector, or whatever other interests they're protecting, right? Do they have to go through customs? Do they have to pay taxes? Things like that. So states regulate the flow of this stuff all the time. What this is really getting at, obviously, is as a deliberate policy measure, deliberately cutting off assistance of this sort. And that's the question here, right? It's a question of a lot of fact-specific assessments that gives the executive branch a lot of leeway in how they interpret and apply this. On the one hand, I'm sure Israel, if you were to ask what it's doing, they would say something to the effect of, we're not trying to stop this assistance going in, but we only want to let the assistance in when we know it's only the assistance. And we know it's being done safely and being given to the people who are supposed to receive it, not Hamas. Right? Because one of the biggest talking points the Israelis have around this is that Hamas just takes this assistance and uses it to increase its leverage over the people of Gaza. In fact, we're empowering Hamas, not helping the people of Gaza from doing this. The Biden administration has come out recently in a number of press statements and said, well, the way you solve problems like that, where Hamas and the other armed gangs that are currently running Gaza because of the complete chaos that's been kicked into, is to just flood the zone and send in so much assistance that there's no one way that they could capture it. And it's not such a big area, not such a big population, that we couldn't do this if we really wanted to. And that's a compelling logic, I think, certainly if you can get the funding together to do that sort of assistance. You can get to the point where 620i, I think you are not going to get to the point in a case like this where the executive branch will feel compelled to apply 620i. I think there's enough gray area created by the formal statements of what the Israelis are doing and why they're doing it and the genuinely difficult facts on the ground to say that they're not trying to withhold this. They're not deliberately blocking this assistance to prevent it from getting to the people who want it. They're trying to pursue other interests that are more like more legitimate state interests. That doesn't necessarily right. Like maybe that's all pretext. But as long as they make those statements, I think the Biden administration is going to be pretty reluctant to openly contradict them, except the consequences that get there. But that also doesn't mean that the Biden administration might not have a very real policy disagreement, which they very clearly do with the Israelis. And now they're bypassing them entirely by just delivering assistance directly to Gaza. That itself is a really notable development, I think, and something worth talking about what that means, because it's part of this trajectory we've seen in the Biden administration the last month or so of kind of putting in more and more mechanisms in place that could exercise leverage over Israel, but don't quite yet. But 620i, I worry, frankly, is a good talking point, something to think about, because clearly Congress had this in mind. But I think it's more of a talking point than anything else. I don't think it actually is a legal restriction that's going to come into play here, barring a real shift in the underlying relationship between the two countries.
Yeah, I hear you. I think that's a good point that 620i is not purely being deployed out of a desire to get aid into Gaza, but I think it's also being deployed by those who are kind of hammering on about it as a way to both get aid into Gaza and block weapons into Israel. I had just a brief follow-up for you, Scott, or Alan and Quinta, about whether or not this 620i could be used by people within the State Department who are making the assessments before delivering security aid to Israel. I think there's been some reporting over the past few months about dissent within the State Department, some overstated, some very credible. So could then those people within the State Department who are overseeing arms transfers point to 620i as a way to block these transfers? Or could the Biden administration or, you know, Biden himself sidestep the State Department as it has done a few times since the conflict began?
Yeah, I mean, the way these things get played out is that you will have somebody write a memo flagging this as an issue, policy offices will raise it, and then it will get elevated up past the State Department to the interagency, to the National Security Council, and then it will be decided. And I don't think at any point that the Biden administration's White House is going to decide to apply 620i unless there's like something really, really goes off the rails, more than we're seeing in the current fact pattern. Doesn't mean it doesn't matter. It creates internal political pressure. It's a talking point that's difficult. And then most importantly, the way these things actually do get enforced, the actual mechanism, is that Congress gets pissed about it. And all of a sudden, the State Department starts getting worried about its funding. And the broader executive branch has to worry about funding for its priorities and having to deal with a bunch of very difficult or politically sensitive writers that are attached to different types of bills. So that dialogue is going to be ongoing. It doesn't manifest as a clear and unequivocal application of 620i, but 620i does play a role because Congress has very clearly put down a marker about what its preferences are, and there is a compelling argument that those preferences aren't being met properly by the executive branch, and that's a problem for Congress, at least when Congress is operating effectively, which query whether it will in this space, I have my doubts. But that is the mechanism by which you see these things enforced, is that sort of interbranch dialogue.
My question here, I think, is what this does mean in terms of the relationship between the United States and Israel. These aid drops also come in a context in which Vice President Kamala Harris stated at an event that she felt there was a need for a ceasefire. I think there's been some confusion and back and forth about what precisely that meant and whether Harris and the White House are on the same page there. But it did strike me as a notable development, specifically given these aid drops. I mean, I feel like every time we've talked about this since, you know, a couple of weeks after 10/7, I've raised the question of, you know, is the United States going to lose patience with Israel? And at this point, it seems a bit like a, you know, an asymptotic curve that we keep getting closer, but we're never actually going to get there. I mean, how do we read this in that context? Is it a shot across the bow? Is it ultimately, you know, another display of distance that doesn't actually manifest in any functional disagreement with the Israeli government? How do we read it?
Well, I mean, I guess I'll just repeat what I've been saying now for a few weeks now, which is it's not clear to me what the United States, quote unquote, losing patience with Israel would look like, given that the United States does not have nearly as much leverage over Israel as I think a lot of observers seem to think. You know, there's this continuing assumption that, you know, there's one phone call Biden could call Bibi and end all of this. And I just don't think that's true. Israel is a rich and powerful country. It does not need America's military support, at least not for this operation. I'm not sure the extent to which America even can stop whatever damage to Israel's international reputation is happening, given that, you know, UN resolutions, binding, non-binding, again, don't really have much of effects on the ground effect. And so, you know, I do think the United States is quote unquote losing patience with Israel. I think the fact that they are literally airdropping supplies into Gaza is extremely embarrassing for the Israelis. And I just don't think it matters that much at the end of the day. I mean, I think it's a point that Scott made, I don't know if it was last week or 2 weeks ago, but this war is popular in Israel, right? It's, you know, obviously not universally and not uncomplicatedly, but ultimately Israel is going to do what Israel wants to do. And I think the levers that the United States has are, you know, relatively limited.
Yeah, I would push back a bit, and I think on the levers question, I think there are though still several levers that the Biden administration hasn't been willing to touch that are much stronger levers than whatever strategy they've been pursuing since the beginning, which seems to be just at first private entreaties to the Netanyahu government, and now much more public. But they still haven't touched the lever of security assistance, intelligence sharing, you know. They're continuing to veto things in the UN, you know, whether they're binding or not, whether they have an effect on Israel or not. So I still think there are just several levers that they haven't even reached for. And I think that's where the criticism comes. And to your point about this being embarrassing for Israel, that I agree. And I think it's equally as embarrassing and damaging for Israel. I don't think the issue here is any more of Israel's international reputation being tarnished. I agree. I think that's been happening and is sort of a foregone conclusion at this point. I think it's now the United States' international reputation that's much more at issue here.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, I think I can't quite agree. I think you have a good point, Alan, in that it is not a one-to-one relationship. The United States is not in the driver's seat over how Israel executes this policy. And the Biden administration is very leaned into that in their public statements, right? They say, we're not checking the homework of the Israeli government, which is a very stupid response. I hate that response when the Biden administration gives it, or State Department, whoever gives it, because that's, of course, not what anybody is asking for or really discussing. But it's their way of saying, oh, no, like, we don't second guess an ally in their policy decisions, and we don't have that much control over them. I do think that's overstating it. There are a lot of ways the United States could really push back in Israel. That's really harmful. The United States could just end its security relationship, could just impose sanctions. It could bomb Jerusalem, right? It could do a billion different things that would be very damaging to Israel. None of that's going to happen because it's politically unfeasible for U.S. domestic politics. The real question is what tools are actually available to the Biden administration that are usable within its political constraints. I think Tyler has a valid point. There are what's there. And we know that because the Biden administration has set them up and begun using them, but in very small, tepid, baby step ways, whether it's sanctions on, you know, West Bank settler violence, whether it is the NSM National Security Memorandum laying out, hey, we actually are going to need assurances on these things, guys. Yeah, probably we should have been getting those earlier, but now they have to be a lot more expressed and include a lot more, or we are accepting that there actually is going to be a cutoff here when we're binding ourselves to the mast on that. Those are all really significant. What we have to bear in mind is that the Biden administration's theory going into this conflict, and they were pretty express about it, was that unlike the Obama administration, if we go in trying to hit the Israeli government and trying to use these tools too liberally, we are going to empower the nationalist instinct in the Israeli electorate that Bibi Netanyahu capitalizes on, among other instincts, and that that's going to actually improve them domestically as a domestic political matter and strengthen his hand. Or at least he's going to be inclined to run against us to try and strengthen his coalition, build them up in opposition to the United States. And we don't want to give him space to do that. We want to pull him in tight in the bear hug. And then from there, hopefully we'll have enough soft influence over him, or back room, not in the public sphere influence, to steer his behavior. That clearly has not worked. Like, that has been a failure. No one should pretend otherwise at this point, at least with Bibi. Now they're trying to do it with Benny Gantz. That's the biggest news of this week. Benny Gantz was in Washington, D.C., right? Meeting at the White House. Not Bibi Netanyahu, Benny Gantz, the head of the opposition, more or less. All right. Part of the war cabinet, part of the people directing the military effort. The Biden administration is willingness to have that meeting. And again, not with the whole war cabinet, with Benny Gantz specifically, the guy who is from the opposition member of it, and talk to him about this. And by the way, it was after that meeting that the Biden administration rolled out the stronger position on a ceasefire, calling for an immediate ceasefire, a shift from its temporary ceasefire language at the United Nations. It's a shot across the bow to Bibi. It's saying that we're not going to play this bear hug approach anymore. Now we're going to try and lean in and build our, you know, strength to other parts of the Israeli populace and government, perhaps. But we're willing to pick that fight with Bibi on your domestic politics. Now, the real question is, where does this go? Because I do think you're going to get to the difficult point where Bibi is going to start running against the United States as trying to limit what it wants to do, and frankly, against the opposition for maybe letting the United States do it. And that is an angle that has worked for him politically in the past. He's in a much weaker position. I kind of would be surprised if it works now, once you get to the actual point of an election. But before you get to an election, there's a lot of inter-coalition politics that might play a lot more effectively in.
Yeah, I will say, reading reporting on Gantz's visit to the White House, which, to clarify, was not with Biden. I don't know to what extent that really matters.
Good catch.
Yeah, so it was with Harris and National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan. I'm just quoting from an Axios story here. A senior Israeli official said that already after the meetings Gantz had on Sunday to prepare for the meetings with White House and State Department officials, the Israeli minister began to realize that the Israeli government, quote, is in deep shit, end quote, when it comes to how the U.S. sees Israel's responsibility for the humanitarian crisis in Gaza. I'm sorry, he's only realizing that now? Like, I think it's really, really telling that it seems like Gantz sort of walked into this meeting and walked out like stunned by how much distance there is between the U.S. and Israel, and perhaps what that says about the extent to which U.S. rhetoric and U.S. policy are sort of not talking to one another, if that makes sense.
And just to add, it may have been the same Axios story, but I know it was Barak Ravid who was reporting that U.S. officials, he didn't really specify who, saw, I think, the twin events of the, you know, the tragedy on the aid convoy, which some are calling the Flower Massacre, others are calling it different things with the airlift are seen, I think, among people in the administration as a turning point. I think he used that quote, which may have led to the Gantz meeting. And I think it's also important to point out that Netanyahu hasn't set foot once in the White House since October 7th. He obviously has a lot on his plate, and I'm sure leaving the country would be difficult. But I think it's not only that Gantz was invited and met with top-level officials, it's also the fact that Netanyahu has not met once at the White House in the United States.
And I'll say part of the reason he met with Harris and Sullivan is because a head of state meeting with somebody beneath head of state would be like in conventional diplomatic protocol, like a fairly big breach. Query how sensitive people are to those things these days. Like in the late 19th century, it would have led to a war in Europe. Who knows what it would lead to today. But people do tend to respect those things. So that's probably the reason. But, you know, if you're not meeting with the president, meeting with the vice president and the national security advisor is about as close as in the White House, very symbolic, about as close as you can get. So that's the biggest shot across the bow we've seen this administration take yet. I think it's a sign that the ship has begun to turn, and the ship really started to turn before the Flower Massacre. Maybe that is going to be the point where they see the political window and they say, nope, this is full on our new strategy. We have to lean into this because this is a moment that the Israelis are going to feel a lot of pressure and maybe this strategy will be more effective. But we saw the signs of it with the West Bank EO and with some of the other measures that we've seen coming out really since the new year.
So moving from something very complicated abroad to what is apparently extremely simple at home, which is the future of American democracy when alleged insurrectionists try to run for president. So earlier this week in, a surprise early ruling that was not a surprise in its outcome, the Supreme Court ruled 9-0 in Trump versus Anderson that states do not have the authority under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment to disqualify candidates, not just for president, but for any federal office. Although they do have the authority to disqualify them for state offices, though, which is somewhat less interesting. As Scott mentioned at the top, while the specific judgment with respect to the Colorado decision was unanimous, the opinion is actually much more fractured than might appear, especially surprising given that the majority tries to call itself a per curiam, which is usually a thing you do when it's a pretty simple, straightforward, unanimous opinion. Let's first start, though, with what all nine justices could agree with, and that was the idea that states don't have the authority to disqualify candidates from federal office under Section 3. And in doing so, the court really focused on the concern over uniformity, and in particular, the lack of uniformity that would arise if different states could choose, you know, whether a particular candidate could be on the ballot for president. Now, I want to start, Quinta, with you about this part, in particular to ask, you know, this court claims that it's very originalist. Even the liberal justices, right, claim at this point. I think Justice Jackson at some point said, we're all originalists. Everyone's an originalist, right? And yet, when you look at American history, it's a pretty states' rights-based theory, right, of how elections actually happen in this country. So, you know, is it fair? Can we actually call this an originalist opinion? Or is this just nine justices, whatever their views, thinking we don't want to deal with this. Let's just get rid of this case as quickly as we can.
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, and look, I'll say, I think the ruling is actually somehow even more fractured than you might have described, in that there was initially a lot of confusion, which I think persists to some extent, about what exactly the judgment that everyone is agreeing on is. Is it saying that states can't disqualify all candidates for federal office, or that states can't disqualify presidential candidates without some kind of act of Congress? So I think I'm not totally clear. I read it as presidential candidates. I think you could read it more broadly. Who knows? I do think it is definitely true that, you know, for a court that has sort of represented the moving of originalism from a kind of insurgent legal theory into mainstream practice, this is not a particularly fine piece of historical work. And that is not just us saying it. Take it from Mike Rappaport, who is a prominent originalist legal scholar, writes the Originalism blog, and put up a blog post about this decision that is called The Originalist Disaster and Trump v. Anderson. So I do think, you know, there is history in this opinion. It's just not very good history. There are some quotes from Reconstruction era members of Congress about what the 14th Amendment supposedly meant. They're arguably taken out of context a bit. Evan Burnick, who's another law professor, has been posting about this a bit. It leaves out like lots of super important context. Like there aren't instances in which states at the time disqualified federal officials or presidential candidates from appearing on ballots in Reconstruction because at this point in time, states weren't responsible for administering ballots.
But you see, Quinta, that was on a Tuesday and this opinion came out on a Monday. So it's totally, that's not how it works. That's not how it works.
Right. So look, I mean, I don't know whether you want to say like this is an originalist opinion that's doing bad originalism or whether it's just not an originalist opinion. It seems clear that, you know, I don't know what to call it. Strict earnest originalism, Will Bode, Michael Stokes Paulson style originalism did not rule the day here, and that this is very much an example of the court clearly wanted to reach a certain decision and sort of futzed around with the logic until it fit into the shape that it needed to go into. And by the way, I'm including the liberals in that. I think there, a lot of the coverage has been kind of like, oh, you know, a conservative court lets Trump off the hook once again. If you read the liberals' concurrence for all of the anger there, and they are, by the way, really angry. They start off, literally the first line of their concurrence is a quote from the Roberts concurrence in Dobbs, which just shows how sort of incandescently pissed they are. And yet they're ultimately arguing over, like, they're kind of nitpicking, honestly. They also agree, like we're saying, that states can't disqualify federal officials slash possibly only presidential candidates. They also don't think that the 14th Amendment is entirely self-executing. They're arguing specifically about the extent to which you need specific implementing legislation by Congress, which the majority thinks needs to sort of adhere to specific criteria in order to implement Section 3. That is ultimately, I think, kind of a thin reed here. If they wanted to, you know, go all out and fashion themselves as defenders of the true meaning of the 14th Amendment, which is sort of the tone of that concurrence, they could have done a lot more. I have seen suggestions that perhaps, you know, there was editing at the last minute, the majority, there was some language in there that maybe was taken out that explains this sort of tone in the concurrence. I mean, like, maybe, but still, ultimately, what they're arguing, I think, just flatly has no basis in law or history, and they have to stand by that.
Yeah, I mean, so there's a really interesting set of remarks actually given just a few days before this by Kevin Newsom, who's a judge on the 11th Circuit, and is a Trump appointee, a conservative judge, a kind of committed originalist, but has come out very critical of this court in certain regards, particularly how it uses originalism. And he says essentially this court is much less into originalism or applies or less originalism, much more into traditionalism, which is essentially originalism asks what was intended when people enacted a particular measure. And traditionalism asks, well, what has been done with it since? And constrains people based off what people did with it afterwards. And you see a lot of that in this opinion. The real logic of this opinion is essential. Well, this is something nobody's ever done before, and this law has been on the books for a long time. We don't see any practice or tradition of it. They say that quite expressly in that terms, the tradition, historic tradition of using the Section 3 this way, and so they don't pursue it that way. The thing to bear in mind, I think Quinta got this, but I'm going to say it maybe a little more bluntly, like this is a very stupid opinion. It does not make much sense, right? Like there's a reason why the agreement among the nine justices around this issue of this idea that, well, no, we don't think that this applies to the states for federal offices in the same way that it applies to states for state offices and at least the presidency, but maybe not federal offices. That was not an argument put forward by any litigants at any stage of this matter, by any amicus at any point. It only became a potentiality when it became very obvious that was the kind of consensus point during oral argument that people were leaning towards. Even then, I was skeptical because I thought it was really hard to square that with what the actual amendment does and how we think about the 14th Amendment. And I still think that's right. It does not hang very well with how we've seen the court approach the 14th Amendment before. 14th Amendment and in other contexts, we don't worry about patchwork enforcement of other qualifications for federal office. We don't worry about the fact that we have highly, highly disparate decentralized means of managing elections and all sorts of other aspects. That is a patchwork system by design that is seen as a feature, not a bug in other contexts, but here it is a bug. We don't see Section 5 as requiring implementing legislation so exclusively, if that is what the majority is saying. So I don't think all of this actually is that justifiable unless you start thinking about the background principles the court is operating around, which is essentially, you know, we think to have the court intervene and have the law prohibit a major actor in a democratic process, we need a lot more clarity. And that's what the argument was. And I kind of wish we were in a position where the court could come out and say that more directly. Instead, we find them patching together this justification that I do not think holds together very well. In a lot of ways, frankly, I think the 9-justice concurrence in the judgment hangs together even worse than the majority argument does regarding Section 5. At least that's internally kind of coherent. But the other one, I just don't see it there. It only makes sense if you think about the background principles motivating this. And I've always thought that's what was going to drive this case. I'm just kind of surprised by, and maybe it's because of the time pressure, that they couldn't get to a more persuasive veil to put over it of legal argument to actually get to that place.
Yeah, I mean, I guess what surprises me is that, I mean, traditionalism is not a verboten form of constitutional interpretation. I mean, how the Constitution has been actually interpreted by the constitutional political actors on the ground over constitutional history is a very standard way, actually, of interpreting constitutional texts. And I think it actually is much better than originalism. I'm actually a big fan of that approach. It's kind of a small C Burkean conservative approach to the Constitution, which I think has always been more quote unquote conservative than originalism, which is not conservative at all. It's actually quite radical, potentially in its, you know, ability to overturn settled practice. So, you know, I'm with you that this is entirely a settled practice argument. I don't think that's a bad argument necessarily. And I actually do think it was within the court's ambit, or the court could have said that more straightforwardly. But I do want to actually get to this Section 5 point, because that is what made the concurring justices quite so angry. So the first thing I want to ask you, Scott, is what exactly is it that the majority said that angered the liberal justices so much?
So this is the weirdest part about this opinion. And the reason why I want to reiterate again, it's extremely stupid. Everyone acted stupidly. It is extremely bad. Because in this case, the three concurring justices, but kind of dissenting justices, the three liberal justices say essentially, we object because the majority opinion, technically a per curiam, but effectively a 5-justice majority opinion, does all these things that to rule out any sort of type of federal enforcement of these measures later by kind of reifying Section 5, making an absolute requirement and saying that that means that you're not going to be able to have other sorts of federal enforcement. And they're subtly implying there, less subtly in one case, more subtly in another, does this they don't think that this reaches the ability to disqualify the president during the electoral count vote. They don't address that squarely, but it seems like an implication they're drawing. And they say quite squarely, we think this means that future people couldn't raise this as a defense, for example, if they were prosecuted by an insurrectionist in a criminal trial. That's the example they put forward, right? The problem is if you read just the majority's opinion, you would not reach that conclusion. The reason we're so convinced that the majority actually got there, I think, is because the concurrence is so vocal and express about saying this is how you should read and understand the majority's opinion. I don't think we read the majority opinion on its face. It says a lot of problematic things for those arguments. It says Section 5 is supposed to be the clear vehicle by which this is actually disqualification is implemented. And then it pokes a bunch of holes in it because it says, but the states, they don't have to wait for federal legislation. They can do it for state officials on their own. And members of Congress or the houses of Congress, they can regulate their own membership on their own. So they don't need federal implementing legislation. So if you start accepting, well, these certain entities have their own independent constitutional authority that don't require legislation, then it creates this backdoor for all these other mechanisms of enforcement. I'm not sure any of them are actually clearly ruled out. That when I read the majority opinion initially, I was kind of convinced, yeah, they are saying it's exclusive. But once they start acknowledging all these other exceptions, the other ones are just, they're silent about, they don't address them. And so I don't think you have to read it that way as them suggesting this is supposed to be determinative for those. But the concurrence is so expressed that that's how this should be read. And that's the problem here. They are shaping the majority's opinion, or at least our understanding of it, in the exact direction that they're most opposed to, in a way that I find just, frankly, quite bizarre. That's part of the reason I'm convinced there was some last-minute editing. I kind of think that we know that Justice Sotomayor was originally writing a concurrence in part and a dissent in part because of metadata in the PDF that was released. It was originally just
scrub your metadata.
Supreme Court needs better IT. This is bad.
I kind of suspect there is some concession, maybe making it just a concurrence, not a dissenting in part, that got the three liberal justices on board. And maybe to make it a per curiam, which would be weird if you had a dissenter, you couldn't really do that. They got the majority, the effective majority, to strip something out of their opinion. And maybe that was something that clarified it. But as it is, it's like they're writing past each other. It's completely bizarre in my sense. It's one of the weirder opinions I've read in recent memory.
I mean, I think one way to read this, and I'm drawing here on work by Josh Chaffetz, who's written about what he calls sort of judicial aggrandizement against Congress and sort of key cases involving presidential power. I think you can kind of extend that here. I'm less certain about the concurrence from the liberals, but if you read the majority, it's kind of like, okay, in the past, the Roberts Court specifically has turned to Section 5 to essentially cramp congressional enforcement of other parts of the 14th Amendment by saying, oh, no, you went beyond your enforcement powers here under Section 5. And here, it's saying, Congress, of course, needs to pass implementing legislation, but the implementing legislation needs to meet these specific criteria that we've set out in our other Section 5 cases. And there's this hilarious line. This is on page 5 of the opinion where it says, the Constitution empowers Congress to prescribe how those determinations should be made. So, great. Congressional power. We love it. Next line. The relevant provision is Section 4, which enables Congress, subject, of course, to judicial review, to pass appropriate legislation to enforce the 14th Amendment. So this kind of reads to me as the court saying, like, we are the top dog here. We get to weigh in. We get to review, you know, Congress, however you might want to enforce Section 3 under the enforcement power that we've now decided that you have to sort of state explicitly. And I think you see that sort of like, please pay attention to us and take us seriously also in Barrett's concurrence, which we haven't referenced, but in my mind is actually one of the more ridiculous parts of this ruling, where she explicitly chides the press, basically not to put in the paper that the Supreme Court got mad. That particularly in this circumstance, she's talking about the court settling a politically charged issue in the volatile season of a presidential election. That's a quote. Particularly in this circumstance, writings on the court should turn the national temperature down, not up. For present purposes, our differences are far less important than our unanimity. Don't tell me what to do. Like the idea that the court not only gets to have the final word here, but gets to have the final word on how people interpret what they've said is completely ludicrous.
No argument there.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 5% off your first purchase with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for 5% off your first purchase.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Sort of widening the scope here, I'm curious, Quinta, especially what you think this decision does for the court's legitimacy, especially in the wake of Dobbs, which was cited, as you mentioned, angrily. Yeah, I think if I could, I wanted to bring in your Atlantic piece. It seemed that the court, as you said, had politics sort of laid at its door. They seem to be, especially Justice Barrett, seems to be wanting to avoid the appearance of political impropriety. But as you mentioned, a ruling for or against is a sort of political question. So I just wanted you to hear your thoughts on that and maybe expand on what you were the point you were making in your Atlantic piece.
Yeah. So as you say, I wrote about this in a dyspeptic article in the Atlantic. I do think that, right, the court, it seems to me that the court, in not disqualifying Trump, which it seems like there's broad agreement among at least the four of us, was the right choice to disqualify, that is. They're trying to sort of back away from plunging into sort of the political thicket at a time when the political legitimacy of the court is really under strain, thanks to Dobbs. Thanks also, the libs also point to Bush v. Gore, right? Which is arguably another point where the court's legitimacy sort of starts to really crumble. But the problem, of course, is that they're sort of caught both ways. If they had found that Trump was disqualified, that obviously would have been a huge step. And I'm sure there would have been lots of rhetoric from Republicans about, how terrible that was and how political it was and so on and so forth. But in ruling for Trump, of course, that is also a political decision in the sense that a Supreme Court, is an institutional actor in American politics. They're making a choice that he will be able to appear on the ballot in the absence of congressional legislation to the contrary, which we all know is not going to happen. And I've been training my fire on the liberals here, but it's also true that a lot of people are going to look at this and say, the conservatives gave him a pass yet again. And so I do think that this kind of emphasizes how the court's sort of desire to protect itself as an institution and protect itself as kind of an institution at a remove from the really difficult political questions we're all political question, not in the legal sense, we're all grappling with in terms of, whether American democracy is it can't work. And they seem to have convinced themselves that there's some kind of a way to do that. And I just don't think that it's possible.
Yeah. One quick caveat there just before give views of truth to me. Like, I'm not sure I do think it was wrong for the Supreme Court to reach this outcome. I think the most persuasive legal case, I was persuaded in the end by a lot of the arguments that Trump, probably the best reading of Section 3 is that it would reach Trump and disqualify him on the plenary of the law. But I also don't think that's how the Supreme Court approaches the law. And I'm not sure it is how the Supreme Court should approach the law. I think it's a really hard question. It's something I have to think about, but I get arguments to the contrary. And I'm not surprised by this outcome as much as some of the inartfulness of it. I think it's the part that I'm mostly surprised by. But on the legitimacy point, obviously this is bad for legitimacy because the dissent really called people out, like really badly about it and framed it in partisan terms. And part of me has to say, I'm not sure that's entirely fair because yes, it is true that like they effectively, if you read the majority opinion like the concurrence does, which again, I'm not sure is actually the most natural or only way to read it. And I'm sure enterprising litigants won't read it that way because they will still be pursuing other legal arguments and it leaves enough wiggle room for them to do that. But if you read the majority as foreclosing these other options, yeah, that does let Trump off the hook, barring Congress trying to do something. But it also does something that I think very smart people were saying would be a really good public virtue thing to do before the election, which is provide, certainty before the 2024 election. We have had a lot of leading legal scholars, election law scholars, like our friends at Foley, and Rick Hassan, I believe, was with them on some briefing and has written similar things to similar effects, making the point that leaving these questions open headed into the 2024 election is really dangerous. Inviting a situation where Congress can come forward and try and disqualify Trump in a way that nobody knows the constitutionality of, which is just going to lead to another judicial review, but then on a question that may not be judicially reviewable. Frankly, I think there's good reason to think it probably isn't. If you look at the court's approach to how the Congress handles these sorts of matters, and in light of that, that could lead to a situation where there's no clearly constitutionally right or wrong outcome, and you see an upending of a presidential election by members of Congress in a way that a lot of countries are going to see as illegitimate. That's like a really, really bad scenario. And there's a good argument, I think, to be made that the least the court should do is foreclose that. the dissenters, the concurrents, I should say, very expressly said, we didn't want to do that. We want to leave those options open. We want to have as narrow opinion as possible. I see that logic in a lot of other cases, but it's a dangerous one here. Maybe the majority tried to reach and foreclose that, but they failed because they didn't, they weren't clear enough. They didn't address it expressly enough. And all these challenges are still going to come forward. I think they threw cold water on it. I think it's hard to reconcile those views with the majority, but they could still pursue it. So long story short, like, you know, I kind of sympathize with the view, like, this is the sort of case where maybe a little stability and certainty would have been a good thing for the Supreme Court to embrace, even if it means stepping out of the more conventionally constrained judicial role. But I don't think they successfully did it, even if that was their intent, meaning the majority.
Yeah, I mean, I will say I found this line from the concurrence extremely bizarre. It complains that the majority, or the per curiam, quote, forecloses judicial enforcement of that provision, Section 3, such as might occur when a party is prosecuted by an insurrectionist and raises a defense on that score. And like, as far as I can tell, what the concurrence is saying is it's really mad at the majority because now you can't claim that the president is illegitimate if you're prosecuted by the attorney general for some random thing. Like, I find a lot of the concurrence extremely bizarre because I get the majority went beyond what it strictly needs to do, but the court does that all the time. And of all the cases to do it, this seems like the one to do it in.
Well, from a little bit of internal dissension in the Supreme Court, let us turn to some internal dissension in the editorial room, or two editorial rooms, or meeting rooms of the New York Times. There has been a really, really difficult discussion happening apparently in the New York Times, we've learned from reporting, and around and a lot outside of it, around a really difficult question. And that's about the role that sexual assault played in the events of October 7th, the horrible massacre that Hamas indisputably perpetrated within Israel on that day and time shortly thereafter. This topic is obviously a very difficult one. It involves questions of sexual assault, context of the armed conflict. And it's an important issue that has triggered very strong feelings from a lot of different corners for very, very good reasons in many cases. But it's one that because of those strong feelings, because of the heat around it, frankly, because of the difficulty of talking about both this topic and some of the politics around the broader conflict of Gaza, there is just a lot of smoke in the air, hard to figure out exactly what's happening. And we thought it would be useful, hopefully, if still challenging, for us to talk over a little bit about what's happening and our sense of our read of the facts to the extent we can as people who try and follow and understand this stuff. So that's what we're going to be digging into with us today. Tyler, let me hand it over to you to set the stage for us a little bit. Tell us a little bit about this controversy, what we know about it, and then also your sense of where things are falling. And then also we just got this UN report, which has come in and found a credible basis for the conclusion that sexual assault did occur on October 7th, was perpetrated by members of Hamas and people that kind of followed Hamas out of Gaza, and in some cases, some civilians who may not be part of the organization but were involved in kind of the invasion of Israel. But tell us how that fits in with the New York Times coverage that has been the center of this heated debate.
I think so. At a broad level, in the wake of October 7th, there were many stories that were very hard to parse because of the chaos of that day and the brutality of the attack and just overall the fog of war. And I think in the wake of that, there have been many attempts to find fact, investigate what happened. And one of those attempts was by the New York Times, which had essentially a three-person team looking into allegations of sexual assault, whether widespread and systemic as an intentional weapon of war, essentially, or if it was more ad hoc and less systemic. So the New York Times put Jeffrey Gettleman, if I'm getting his name correct, a Pulitzer Prize-winning sort of veteran of the newsroom, and paired him with two freelancers, one person who has been sort of the focus of a lot of this controversy is an Israeli filmmaker without, as I understand, news reporting experience. I think the intention was for Gettleman to be sort of act as the editorial control from the New York Times point of view. So they issued a pretty explosive report in the New York Times, laying out fairly extensive accounts of sexual violence, sexual assault perpetrated against Israelis by Hamas fighters, often underage girls were involved. And then fast forward to some time later, The Intercept, a few reporters of The Intercept come out with their own reporting of calling to question the reporting done by the New York Times team. This also, at the same time, The Intercept reported that The Daily, which is on the audio side of the New York Times, a hugely popular, massive podcast, were planning on running an audio adaptation of the New York Times report, but it failed to pass muster, according to The Intercept, with The Daily's own fact-checking team. So it's an interesting split between the sort of the traditional written copy newsroom versus this ascendant audio arm that is playing out, I think, across journalism. And then fast forward to a few days ago when the UN issued its own report finding very credible evidence that sexual assault did take place, but perhaps not on the same wide scale level that the New York Times reporting suggested, and calling into question some specifics of the New York Times story, specifically at one kibbutz that a lot of the New York Times reporting was focusing on. The UN report said that some of those allegations were, quote, unfounded and couldn't substantiate them. So I think that set the scene for this sort of these dueling narratives between the New York Times, The Intercept, the UN, some of them overlapping, some of them in direct tension. And so I think one of the reasons we wanted to talk about this is it sort of brings up this meta question of you know, why it's so important, why specifically sexual assault, I think, raises, you know, so many emotions, and what the use or misuse of these narratives can actually, you know, what the motivations are for owning this narrative. So I think that's sort of the lay of the land, but feel free to jump in or correct any parts of that.
Yeah, first off, I would recommend a really good podcast that our executive editor, Natalie Orpett, did with Alan, with your colleague, Fionnuala Niolan, on the difficulty of investigating and prosecuting sexual abuse in wartime. This was in context of reports about sexual abuse in Ukraine. But I think it really gets to a lot of why this is so difficult. And a part of it is just that, like, it's really hard to build a case. It's something around which, obviously, there is a lot of shame. There's a lot of trauma. People don't want to talk about it. Obviously, if the victim is dead or missing, they can't testify to it. And so it makes for sort of a particularly complex issue in a context that is already, you know, really difficult to untangle, both in terms of just figuring out the mechanics of what happened and also in terms of the sort of emotional valence of what happened. Because, of course, it, you know, this can be used as a rallying cry, you know, they attacked our women, so on and so forth. So I think that is useful to keep in mind. And something that I took away from that conversation with Natalie and Fionnuala, which I was listening to before we started recording, is that there's a big range of how sexual violence appears in wartime. There are some contexts in which it's sort of systemic and used as a weapon. So I think it's fair to say that an example of this is during the genocide in the former Yugoslavia, when there were a lot of reports about Serbian soldiers raping Bosnian women. And then there are situations where it doesn't particularly happen, and there are situations where it sort of happens, but in more of a scattered way, rather than as a sort of, you know, systemic strategic weapon. And my impression after reading through a lot of this reporting, including the UN report, is that it seems like part of what happened here is that the Times kind of initially presented it as more of a systemic approach by Hamas, whereas what the UN seems to document is more along the lines of, you know, this is something that probably did happen in some places, but not in all of the places and not in all of the ways in which it was initially reported. And I think it's also worth noting that, you know, that UN report has also received criticism from the Israeli government, which is very angry about it because it felt that the UN wasn't strong enough. I should also note, to the point about the difficulty of documenting these things. I mean, the UN report actually explicitly says at one point, like, look, we didn't have a lot of time. We didn't have a lot of, you know, the investigative teamwork that was available. We also had trouble talking to people because they didn't want to speak to us, either because they didn't want to relive what had happened to them, or because they didn't trust the UN, which I think just gets to a lot of the thorniness here. And I've been talking for a while, so I'll shut up in a second. But just to say one quick thing, I think that one thing that's really important to keep in mind here is just the sort of the different standards. I think that there's been a really disturbing, frankly, response to the Intercept report I've seen from people on the left who have used this to sort of deny that any sexual violence took place on 10/7 at all. I don't think we have evidence of that. And part of that is an insistence on sort of, you know, rock solid beyond a reasonable doubt standard, which of course you would want to see if you were prosecuting any of these individuals who allegedly perpetrated this in a court of law. But I think for the purpose of sort of reporting on an investigation of these potential actions, keeping in mind how difficult it is to investigate and report on sexual assault, it is reasonable to expect that there would be some difficulty in identifying and corroborating certain allegations.
Yeah, I mean, to repeat what Quintus said, but less politely. I mean, I think there's just a lot of hypocrisy on some parts of the left about the standards that normally people on the left would apply to allegations of sexual assault versus what's happening in this case. Now, there may very well also be hypocrisy on the right, in which folks who are more skeptical of allegations of sexual assault are being less skeptical now. So, you know, hypocrisy might be on all sides here. But I think that's also worth pointing out, right? And I think this is also part of, you know, why reports of sexual assault in wartime are so powerful, right? It's not just what Quintus said about, you know, they're raping our women is a very powerful thing that, you know, you can say when you're prosecuting a war that is also true. It's that within elite opinion, you know, over the last several decades, there's been a real culture shift in recognizing that sexual assault is a huge problem and needs to be taken very seriously. And that often it has been viewed too skeptically in the past. And so, you know, when allegations of sexual assault happen, that becomes a very difficult thing to sort of push back on, I think, for those reasons, which I think is further why this is such a hot button issue.
I mean, I think that is right and not in a wartime context, but I'm not sure if that extends to the context of war. I mean, again, I referenced the Bosnian genocide earlier, right? Like that use of systematic rape by Serbians was identified as a potential crime against humanity or a potential act of genocide at the time, if I'm remembering correctly. So I do think, you know, while there's certainly been more acknowledgement of sexual violence in wartime, that perhaps goes hand in hand with a sort of recognition that sexual violence in peacetime is also a problem, I don't know if I think it's quite a one-to-one.
You know, I also think it's really important that we not blur these distinctions about what people are and aren't denying and lump allegations, because there's different parts of the story that are being used different ways. Some people may well reject the idea that Hamas engaged in any sexual assault, or members Hamas did. That, I think, is very clearly factually problematic. And I think the UN report confirms that. Like, there are very credible cases that are made of that sexual assault happened on October 7th and its aftermath, possibly by members of Hamas, certainly by, most likely by members of Hamas, in addition by people who kind of followed Hamas out of Gaza, who were involved in the kind of subsequent sacking of nearby communities, right? Like, I don't think there's much doubt about that. And it's important that people believe that. And maybe that's kind of like the closest parallel to whether we believe people, the standard about crediting accounts of this, right? But that's a very different question than what is the focus of a lot of the, I think, policy debate and controversy around this, which is the extent to which this was a deliberate policy of Hamas. And that is a separate question from whether you believe people. You can fully believe people, as I think you should give a strong, you know, presumption in favor of believing people who state these allegations and present it. And there might have been widespread sexual assault on October 7th. That could be true. And it could also be true that that was not a deliberate result of Hamas's policy. And it is also true to bear in mind that even if that's the case, that does not excuse anything on Hamas's part. Hamas has massacred people in their homes. They're a horrible organization. They're people who have done horrendous things, and it is quite easy for me to believe that sexual assault may have been a part of it quite deliberately. Or maybe it wasn't. Maybe their allegations there are true as well. But there seems to be this narrative that blends together these ideas of, well, we have to believe survivors, and that means that Hamas clearly deliberately was directing these people to do these things. Those two things don't match up to each other. And at the same time, excusing the fact that Hamas might not have deliberately employed sexual assault as a tool of its offensive on October 7th in no way excuses the horrible things it very clearly did and openly acknowledges it did that are as horrible and equally weren't being condemned. And the idea that this could play into that valorizing narrative that some people have bought into of Hamas, that's objectionable on a million different fronts unrelated to this, in addition maybe to this one. But they're separate debates that are happening that we really have to keep distinct. And blending them together, I think, is really dangerous and contributes to a lot of the smog around this topic, as I phrased it up top, a lot of the harmful confusion and kind of obfuscation of what we're actually talking about.
So I'm really glad you brought that up, Scott, because that has been honestly my puzzlement this whole time, both as we've been preparing to have this conversation and having it, which is what turns on this distinction. Now, obviously, from a kind of media ethics, media criticism point, journalists need to get their facts right. So if they screwed up, the New York Times screwed up in that reporting, that's a problem, right? But I'm not that interested in this first instance focusing on the New York Times so much, right? Though, granted, right, reporters have to get their jobs right. Okay, so putting that to aside, there may be legal issues, right? You know, I think my understanding is that a lot of what constitutes as a war crime can depend on premeditation and planning. Okay, fine, fair enough. But at the end of the day, right, if, you know, brutal sexual assault and rape occurred, which it sounds like the best evidence suggests that it did on a non-inconsiderable scale, right? That to me seems like that's the margin at which you're going to evaluate, right, how horrible the attack of 10/7 was. Now, it would have been worse if this had been premeditated. Yes, that seems true. But, you know, if the question is, was this a horrible thing that, you know, that justifies in some sense, right, an Israeli response? To be perfectly honest, I'm not sure the premeditation point matters that much. And let me draw an analogy, right? In the early months of the war in Ukraine, of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, right, we were getting reports of horrible atrocities being committed by the Russian military against Ukrainian civilians. And there was some question about, and I think we even talked about this on the podcast, was this premeditated? Was this a intentional, you know, terroristic strategy on the part of the Russian military? Or was this a result of, you know, an extremely undisciplined Russian military? We had an interesting debate about that. But I recall us concluding that at the end of the day, it didn't matter that much, right? If Ukrainian civilians were butchered in this horrible way, they were butchered in this horrible way. That was the focus here. And so I guess what I'm struggling with is, why does it matter so much for the main questions that we care about in this war, whether or not this is premeditated or not? And the reason that I actually suspect it doesn't matter so much is precisely the point that you, Quinta, made earlier, which is that many people, some people, right, are taking the questions raised about the New York Times reporting, and they're using that to deny that any sexual assault or rape took place. Now, why are they doing that? I think the reason they're doing that is because they recognize that that's actually the important question, right? That the question is, did rape took place, not was it premeditated? That's the important question for the broader messaging war, as crude as it is to put it in those framing, around what happened on 10/7. And so that's what I keep getting stuck on here.
Yeah, Alan, I actually agree with you that this distinction matters less because the sort of lesser side of the distinction is bad enough. You know, it's horrific enough. But I would then also ask the same question to the Israeli government, who does, in some instances, seem to be embellishing these horrific acts that are taking place. So I think another horrific example from early on, where all these reports of 40 babies being beheaded, which reporting I've seen since then hasn't really been substantiated. So I've also, that's the same question has been gnawing at me, Alan, but I also would flip it over to the Israeli government and these Israeli sources of information that, you know, what occurred on October 7th was bad enough. So why the need to embellish? And I think the answer is that it's almost like a wartime propaganda motivation.
Well, folks, we will have to leave this complicated conversation where it is for the time being, as we are out of time. But this would not be Rational Security if we did not leave you with some object lessons to ponder over in the week to come. Alan, what do you have for us this week?
So my object lesson is the perfect antidote to all these weighty issues. When you just want to turn your brain off and be entertained, I recommend you watch Netflix's apparently 6-season documentary, Formula One: Drive to Survive. I'm only on season 2. So it is about Formula One, which apparently is about fast cars that are drive really fast in circles in exotic, mostly European locations. This was suggested to my wife and me, though I think my wife had already been watching it, by some friends of ours in the neighborhood. And I was extremely skeptical. I'm generally not like a big sports fan, but I have found this documentary. And to be honest, all of the other Netflix sports documentaries, there's like a good tennis one. Like they have a lot of these like floating around. It's amazing. Like it just shows that anything when reported on well is interesting. And it turns out like who knew, right? Formula One is completely fascinating. And I am like the farthest from a car guy. So, you know, I just recommend it. There's drama. It's shot in the most like gorgeous way possible. Like the cars are legitimately impressive. The drivers are actually all like really nice. Which is something I did not expect. I thought to be a lot more arrogant, but they're actually like mostly like chill dudes. It's all dudes. So I really like, I am shocked that I'm recommending a 6-season Formula One documentary on Netflix, but it is fabulous. Have any of you guys watched it?
I haven't, although I will say my entry point to like getting back into sports after like 2 decades away was documentaries. It was the OJ documentary that was out, 10 years ago on ESPN. That's just still phenomenal and great, worth watching.
I even watched that documentary.
It's
That's
so
how good.
It was. It's so compelling. And then that led me into 30 by 30. And then all of a sudden I was watching football again. And, you know, it is a dangerous path. So if you think you're not into sports, like try out the documentary route and see if it takes. It's pretty amazing once you put it in the narrative and historical perspective. It really like puts more color on things in ways that makes it so much more compelling.
I will also add the other Netflix sports documentary that is worth watching is the Tour de France one. That one is straight up amazing.
I've heard great things. Yeah.
I think that's so. That one's incredible.
And Scott, I thought you were going to mention The Last Dance, because I think that's what also pulled me back into sports.
Yeah. The Last Dance is amazing. Totally agree.
Are we going to do a spinoff podcast where we all just watch sports documentaries and then talk about them while eating? That can be like our mukbang sports documentary spinoff. Rational sports. Security sporks. Okay, I'm done.
This may actually relate to my object lesson, but Quinta, I'll let you go first. Quinta, go ahead.
Mine is not about sports. Mine is about gold bars. Folks, it happened. We have another superseding indictment.
Dirty jerks.
Robert Menendez. I just want to say it took
the hero we deserve, but the hero we need or something.
So by my calculations, it took like 4 months from the first indictment to the first superseding indictment, and then 2 months from the first superseding indictment to the second superseding indictment. So if this is going as a geometric series at not too far from now, maybe by mid-April, we'll start getting an indictment every other day, and then every day, and then every 12 hours, and so on and so forth. There are new charges. There is not a new Middle Eastern country involved, unfortunately. The allegations against Menendez are still focused on Egypt and Qatar. But this indictment has new allegations about Menendez and his wife attempting to cover up a bribe by making it look like a loan. And this, of course, is the bribe that allegedly took the form of a Mercedes-Benz gifted to Nadine Menendez. So, folks, it goes on. I'm excited. It's a great state. No one's doing it like us.
I will say, if Lawfare wants more information on the Menendez controversy, they are welcome to buy me a first class Acela ticket in the hopes of running into Bob Menendez again. And maybe I can ask him about
That's
this.
That's right. Yeah, maybe you'll have more luck the second time around.
Well, for my object lesson, I frankly was going to do a fairly dry book that would only appeal to a handful of people on the podcast, which I'm going to mention just because I feel like I need to, because it's very good. This is the book Bucking the Buck that I've been reading by Daniel McDowell, which is, I think, the best empirical assessment of de-dollarization as relationship to sanctions I've read. It's very readable for a fairly dry policy book. This is why I don't do a lot of book recommendations, because these are the books I tend to be reading at any given moment. And they're not always of broad interest, but this one I quite enjoy.
Nerd.
It was a good take of the topic. Hey, but you know, instead I'm going to also give an object lesson to something else that's only going to be of interest probably to no one listening to this podcast, which is a sports podcast, because they're my parasocial friends. And and I like them. And I have spent so much time, even though football season over, I still spend so much time listening to them. And I'm subtly pitching a reformulation of the Lawfare podcast structure to emulate theirs. And that's the Ringer NFL show. It's just phenomenal. I love the whole Ringer network. I like all their writing. Their NFL show, which they have like three different football shows at any given moment, are all phenomenal. And I'm just going to use this opportunity to put a plea out there, because a lot of the guys involved in the network, Stephen Heifetz, I think you guys know who you are. You live in DC. Why is there not a Philly special equivalent for DC sports? We got a lot of good DC sports teams actually in the last couple of years. For the first time in my lifetime, we've got a football team that we don't have to be openly ashamed of anymore for the first time in the last several decades. So I think it's time. And I even got the title for you, Championship Beltway. It's perfect. It's the regional sports podcast we all need in DC. Please make it happen. I want you guys to do it before somebody bails beat you to that title. Tyler, what do you have for us this week as your object lesson?
Wow. First, I'll just say that's why you're the pun guy, Scott. That was.
Is that not good. A good title? That's good. A really good title. Championship Beltway, guys. Come on. Inside the Championship Beltway, if you really want to get into it.
I like it. So for my object lesson, I'll keep with Alan's theme of escapism. I think it was 2 weekends ago now, I was transported to the mythical realm that is conjured up by medieval times. It's been around a while, but I want to remind listeners that it exists. I went to Lyndhurst, New Jersey, and I was blown away. There's jousting.
Did you meet Bob Menendez, the local goldsmith?
I'm on the Bob Menendez beat. I thought maybe he's just laundering money through medieval times, but I was not disappointed. It's a kitschy, campy, amazing experience. The food is disgusting, but the show is incredible.
Did you have a turkey leg?
I did. And there you were, silverware, I guess, as is historically accurate or not, is not allowed there. So you had to grab the greasy turkey leg with your hands and make do.
As a regular attendee of the Maryland Renaissance Festival, I full-heartedly endorse this. Jousting is cool. We should never have stopped. Got to keep it going, guys.
And I will say, if you want to go down a Wikipedia medieval times hole, the New Jersey Medieval Times Knights unionized back in 2022. There's a New York Times article about it.
Yes, I was very happy when this happened. Solidarity.
Please tell me they're like Teamsters or something. They're like Teamster Knights or something.
And if anyone out there listening has any a t-shirt with the Knights, the Medieval Times Knights Brotherhood on it, please send it my way, because I'm searching for that.
All of our ways. I would love that. That would be amazing. Well, folks, that brings us to the end of this week's episode. Rational Security is, of course, a production of Lawfare. So be sure to visit us at lawfaremedia.org for our show page with links to past episodes, for written work and the written work of other Lawfare contributors, and for information on Lawfare's other phenomenal podcast series, including The Aftermath, now out in season 2. While you're at it, be sure to follow us on Twitter or X at RATL Security, and be sure to leave a rating or review wherever you might be listening. Also, sign up to become a material supporter of Lawfare on Patreon for an ad-free version of this podcast and other special benefits. For more details, visit lawfaremedia.org/support. Our audio engineer and producer this week was Noam Osband of Goat Rodeo, and our music, as always, was performed by Sophia Yan. We are once again edited by the wonderful Jen Patchow. On behalf of my co-host Alan Quinta and our special guest Tyler McBrien, I am Scott R. Anderson, and we will talk to you next week. Until then, goodbye.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.